Hi, I'm Matthew Lloyd, the director of photography of Spider-Man Far From Home, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, you'll learn the secrets of shooting blockbuster comic book movies with the cinematographer for Spider-Man Far From Home, Matthew Lloyd. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, buy, rent, create at rule.com, Hedge.video, the fastest way to backup media, Shutterstock.com, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Oh my God, so much to get to today. We are talking all about Spider-Man Far From Home and big, huge comic book movies and big, huge action sequences and all the behind-the-scenes stuff that you need to know about how these films are shot. And Matthew Lloyd does a great job of explaining it, is very honest and revealing, and there's so much in this episode that you guys are absolutely going to love. But I want to bring your attention real quickly to a couple of things. First, we have been asking more and more audience questions on the show. And the way to get your question on the show is by following us on social media. So on our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all of them can be found by just putting in Go Creative Show. Whenever we have guests coming up, we post about it and we let you know, and you have an opportunity to ask your questions in the post. So you'll hear a couple of audience questions today, but that's the best way to really have your voices heard on the show. And we've been doing it quite a bit, and it's been working out great. The guests love it, we love it, and we want to keep doing more of it. So follow us on all of those platforms. You'll get a chance to have your question asked on the show. But before we get to our interview, I want to talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Now, Magnanimous Rentals is a rental house based in Chicago, but they ship all over the country. So you don't have to be in Chicago to take advantage of what I'm about to tell you. Now, Magnanimous Rentals, you can find them at magrents.com, M-A-G-R-E-N-T-S.com. They've got a great inventory, but where they really shine is their prices. Now, they are obsessed with prices. Their regular prices are incredible, but then they also offer these things called flash discounts. And these are prices that are noted in red, and there's like a big lightning bolt. I'm looking at it right now. These are excellent because they are steeply, steeply discounted prices, sometimes 50% off. But they're for a limited time. Let me give you an example. Now, this offer may not be available when you go on the site, but that's fine because there'll probably be something different. But just to give you an example, right now, one of their flash prices is a Red Epic W 8K. A three-day rental for this is under $400. For 3 days! That's not $400 a day. That's $400 total. Now, that's an insane price, and that's what you get over at magrents.com, especially with their flash discount. So here's what you do to take advantage. You go to magrents.com every day, and at the very least, see if they have a flash discount going on. And the cool thing is as long as you place your order while the flash discount is going on, you don't need your shoot doesn't have to be while the flash discount's happening. You just have to place your order while the flash discount is happening. So that's what you need to do. So it's a site you should check out every single day. I know I do, and I've already rented a bunch from them with flash discounts, and wow, does it make a difference to your overall budget. So head over there, magrents.com, M-A-G-R-E-N-T-S.com. Okay. Let's dive in. There is so much to talk about with the cinematographer from Spider-Man Far From Home, Matthew Lloyd. So I'm here with Matt Lloyd, the cinematographer for Spider-Man Far From Home, and so happy to have you here on the Go Creative Show, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
I just saw the movie yesterday, and I think it just came out yesterday. It was like a 3 o'clock showing. The theater was packed. I mean, this is going to be a massive film. How does it feel knowing that we're just, what, day two into what is probably going to be one of the biggest movies of the summer?
Yeah, definitely. You know, anytime that much effort, energy, and intellect is invested into one product, you definitely want to see it do well. I mean, I have now an ongoing relationship with Marvel that spanned a few movies, and you sort of get a sense when they feel pretty good about something. And so I won't say it's totally surprising, but we are always really, really happy to see these things do well.
Is it kind of stressful to be working within like the Marvel universe in the way that the expectations are so high? Like if a Marvel movie doesn't make hundreds of millions of dollars, it's a failure. You know what I mean? And that, it's like, do you feel any pressure like that?
It certainly has become that way. I think, you know, the lovely thing about working with the gang at Marvel, you know, and obviously Sony is the studio on the Spider-Man franchise.
Yeah.
But working within the creative channels of Marvel Studios is that it really feels like it started from a very small, tight group and sort of grew into this thing that now is a global phenomenon. And so when you're doing the movies, they feel very sort of family based. Like you're seeing the same people, and they're very often they're bringing someone who's just finished one movie onto another, and people that have worked in that way before. So once you're into that world and into that language and style of movie making, the pressure doesn't necessarily equate to the scale of what you're doing all the time, because you really feel supported and you really feel like there are people there who, you know what the movie is meant to be and strive to make it the best it can be and are always totally prepared to throw out something that's not working, even if you're in very late stages of preparing it in the interest of serving a better movie and better ideas and always kind of pushing the envelope. So, it doesn't feel, you know, often I get asked about kind of studio filmmaking and how it can be. And certainly Marvel is the best experience I've ever had as a group of people who are just focused on making really great stuff. And it shows, you know, it shows in the history of the work and in, you know, Spider-Man specifically. I think you get that sense.
What was your first step into the Marvel cinematic universe from your side of things?
Well, I had done, you know, I had done the Daredevil program for Netflix years ago, which was sort of at a time when there was a little bit of overlap. Subsequently, you know, the movie side has become its own complete entity onto itself. And so I didn't really know much about the movie side while doing the Daredevil series, but sort of after that and after it being sort of a reasonably successful result, you know, I got a call to come and meet on the movie side. And I ended up with a friend of mine, Taika Waititi, actually doing additional photography on Thor Ragnarok. That was 2017, I suppose.
Yeah.
So a sizable bit of that movie, you know, also was a great result. And so from there, I was kind of in the mix, and I had known John previously from, you know, years in commercials. John Watts, who directed Spider-Man Homecoming and the new installment, Far From Home. And so he had kind of looked into seeing if I'd be able to do this one, and it worked out, and I had a relationship with Marvel in place, so it all just sort of fell together.
You must have been, like, you're, you know, very humble about it, very low-key about it. You know, you said, he called me, it worked out. I'm thinking to myself, when you got called, and you've done the series, and that's great, you did additional photography on Thor, that's great, but when you're going to be the director of photography for the new Spider-Man movie, that is an elevation in your career for sure. And is that something where, did you kind of feel like that was coming, or did you still have to lobby really hard for that?
No, sort of, most of the lobbying had been done, I had done some films with a great director by the name of Dean Israelite, who, you know, we did Project Almanac at Paramount. We did Power Rangers at Lionsgate. So there had been some comparable scale at that point. So it's all about, the thing with, big movie productions, it's just demonstrating skill sets. So, you know, the minute that there's a body of work that somebody can look at and feel comfortable, there's less of the lobbying and it's more about just the specifics of how it could work out and are you the right person and, personalities and all that sort of thing. Like the big thing for, and I say this a lot to younger folks who are coming up, it really doesn't matter how, when, or why the work gets made. There just needs to be work there that demonstrates both, sort of technical prowess and also some kind of visual sensibility that's going to captivate people that are looking at it. And once that body of work exists, it can be, with the help of reps and all the people that are in your orb and infrastructure to help make these deals happen, they can frame the work in different contexts and say, oh, well, I remember when I was sort of lobbying to get the Power Rangers movie at Lionsgate, I had done, Almanac with Dean, which was smaller, but had, some visual effects stuff going on, some pretty dynamic camera stuff going on in the movie. But it wasn't quite at the scale that they were looking for. But I had done, boatloads of commercials with huge VFX components and huge action, just that had scale.
Yeah.
And so I remember we had to sort of pare down this reel and send it over and be really specific about what they should be looking at to try to demonstrate that ability. That worked. So I think that, for, and a bit of a digression, but for those who are looking to advance and grow the scale of the kind of jobs that they're doing, it's just all about having a good base of work that you've done and how you can contextualize it for people that are looking to hire a director of photography and make them comfortable with what you're going to be able to do for them.
Was that kind of a personal goal for you back however many years before you really started with these big action sequences and films? Did you say to yourself, like, okay, this is the type of filmmaking I want to be doing. This is what I'm interested in. Or did it just kind of come to you?
Yeah, I've never been interested in the idea that, this is the type of thing I want to be doing. I get great fulfillment from, being around good people, being around good directors and producers who have vision, who know what they want to do, and being able to be kind of at their side making it happen. Like, that's kind of the juice for me more than anything is, mm-hmm. All right, what are we after here and how do we do it? And how is it done well? And how is it executed well? And how is it, achieved in the most, sort of most exciting way possible? And that extends to, commercials, TV, $200 million movies, $2 million movies. I think that you really, especially in this day and age, that the conversation has to be bigger than, oh, I only want to do, period dramas, or, oh, I only want to do, kind of action stuff. Yeah. Like, it just doesn't, it's not a place that I was operating from at any point. It was always just one thing leading to the next, being around good people, being around people that I felt that I could help achieve something, because there's a lot of people out there who don't ultimately want help from a director of photography. You know what I mean? You just sort of are there and going through the motions and living in a dit tent, kind of coloring shots is what, it can become that, unfortunately.
So you find some people just kind of want you to just do it. This is my vision. You do it. And,
which is totally their prerogative. And, you have to be able to mold yourself to the situation that you're in. And look, there are a lot of great directors out there who really are, DPs in their own right. You know what I mean? They haven't done that sort of as a career path, but they have the same skill sets. There's sort of an inclination amongst camera people to sort of say, well, this is our territory, you know, and there's meant to be some kind of division of, you know, back to Orson Welles and Greg Toland and Citizen Kane sharing that title card. You know, it's like there was this sort of idea that there's performance and staging and that's sort of a directorial thing. And then there's camera and lighting and shot execution, which is sort of a DP thing. And I think now it's really, with digital being as it is and that people can actually see what they're doing as they're doing it and sort of the mystique of photochemical separation of church and state is gone for the most part. You have to be more open to the types of collaborations that you're going to have. And you have to be willing to, you know, have a director look at something and say, I don't like how this is lit. You know, we got to change it. You know, whereas in film days, it was a different conversation. Well, and we'll print it down and we'll do this and that. It's like the tools are so open now that you have to embrace different types of relationships. Like, you know, I finished a movie yesterday that was very much a true collaboration with a director who, you know, had acted for many, many years, but was directing his first film and you know, really, there was a lot of conversations about editorial. There was a lot of conversations about how shots get structured in a sequence to create a finished scene. And, you know, you're not having those conversations with somebody like John Watts because he's so ingrained in his movie making process that I don't have to talk about, does this cut to that? And do we need a close up and doing it? You know, it's a different type of relationship and still a fulfilling one, you know? So you just have to be very fluid, I think, with the types of people you're inviting into your world and how those relationships are going to work in the heat of the moment.
I want to talk about Spider-Man from a visual effects standpoint for just a little bit here. Sure. Obviously, huge movie, lots of visual effects, but I'd like to hear from you how you prep for that. What does the preparation look like when you have these big, giant VFX scenes?
Extremely extensive.
Yeah.
Many, many, many iterations of pre-visualized sequences. Many, many hours spent with the visual effects supervisor in their office pouring up. You know, the specific, that's just sort of out of the box stuff that's happening on every job that has that amount of visual effects in it. There's a built-in period to sort of get it together on what this stuff's going to look like, how it's going to integrate, what the onset implications are going to be.
And how long is that just in general? Like, is that, well, not even in general, like for you guys, for Spider-Man Far From Home, how long was that previs process?
Well, it started when on Director Scouts in February. We didn't shoot until late June or early July. I mean, it's a long time. And there's, because of the fluidity of the Marvel process, there's stuff that gets prepared that doesn't end up getting shot. There's stuff that gets shot that wasn't the intended because it is, you know, they're just so singularly focused on making the best possible movie all the time.
Yeah.
That things change, you know, and you have to just be ready for that, you know, and that's part of what it is. I think specifically in Far From Home, the challenge was these are real world places where obviously not much of what's happening on screen can occur, but it has to be photographed in such a way that it can integrate with real locations where we are going to shoot. We have to know what sections of these real world places we're going to have to build. The build is always the thing that drives everything about locking in choices, because there's just a finite amount of time that it takes to physically construct a set, to rig it, to wire it, to have it ready to go. So you sort of have the art department and the construction people saying, look, if you want a set to shoot on this day, we got to pull the trigger on this day. And that sort of is when you start locking in. But that said, you know, I mean, you're building chunks of, you know, historic monuments that have to be totally photo ready, photo accurate. You know, we spend a lot of time figuring out on outside sets, figuring out how to orient them so that the sun path is correct. And so that the time of day when you're going to be doing the stuff on the location is going to tie into the stuff on the set in the back lot. For stuff that has to be indoors, you know, what portions of these things are we building? How are they lit to integrate into what's going to happen on location? Like, everything in Far From Home has real European, identifiable European location work.
Yeah, for the for the people that don't know, basically your characters span across all of Europe. I mean, you end in London, but you're in Italy. Where else are you? It goes everywhere. It's Prague, I think. And of course, it's the most iconic places from all of these countries.
Right.
You know, why wouldn't you? So, I guess, how much are you shooting in the actual location versus on sets that you build?
Well, it's a funny process, really, because ideally you would be doing the location work first to sort of understand what it is, understand what you can get for real.
Yeah.
And then going back and building the chunks that you need. Unfortunately, that never works out.
What do you mean? Why?
Well, because just scheduling won't allow for it. You know, in order for a movie to get made, you need a home base, you need a production office, you need to get people started building stuff. You need to, you know, there's so much to do on movies of this scale that you can't really just sort of say, okay, well, we're going to go shoot 5 weeks of continental Europe and then come back and start building the pieces we need. I mean, that's just, it would never work from a scheduling, logistics, and budgetary perspective. So what ends up happening is you scout them to death. I mean, we were in each of those places at least 3 to 5 times before we shot. You know, extensive photography is done, you know, still photography is done of all these places. Then you start to build them in 3D and figure out, okay, well, obviously we're not blowing up this thing, so we're going to need to put that on a stage, and where we need to do our physical effects, we're not going to be able to do that there, so that needs to be on a back lot. And so, you know, we, the process is really about, you know, what parts of the real thing are we extracting and doing in a controlled environment? You know, and it just takes a remarkable amount of time and effort and foresight of just, I just don't know if we're going to be able to get that on location. We would absolutely will be able to get that on location. You're asking a lot, you know, you're asking to put, you know, techno cranes in the Grand Canal of Venice, Italy. I mean, it's, you know, a big ask. So, as you suggest, it does take an incredible amount of time to sort out.
So during the pre-vis process, like what, some people may not even really understand what pre-vis is. Can you just sort of explain what that is and then also give us a little bit of an insight into how that process went for you?
Well, I would say the pre-vis comes in many shapes. I mean, it's essentially any visual document that's created that describes how a sequence will be cut together in the end. So in the big movie version, it is literally, you know, 3D animated sequences with, you know, renderings of the real characters in motion with shots and correct lens sizes and real locations that have been built in 3D that, you know, it's to scale correct.
Wow.
Or for, you know, what, and the reason we do that is because, you know, there's so many pieces to these things and some stuff is wholly CG, some stuff is actors, you know, in a CG environment, some stuff is truly location work, some stuff is CG effects, some stuff is physical effects, meaning real explosions, real water work, real whatever it is. You know, you sort of have to be able to look at a shot and say, okay, you know, that's going to be the actor. We're going to do that on stage. That's going to be a plate in the location, and we're going to burn that thing, and we're going to have the water come crashing through here, or we're going to have the thunderbolts, or whatever it is. You have to be able to say within a given shot, you might have 3 or 4 different pieces that need to get shot in different places months apart, depending on the schedule and availability and when you're going to be in different, you know, on the location, on the set, whatever it is, elements. So pre-vis helps to identify all of that. It also helps us look at a sequence and say, okay, that thing can be done on a 50-foot techno crane. That's a wire cam. That's a, you know, low angle wide unmanned camera and a crash housing. That's a, you know, steady cam off the back of a tracking vehicle, you know, whatever it is, you have to be able to identify the tools and know going in, okay, we're going to do these pieces today. We need this gear. That's sort of the big movie version. The small movie version, which I've also seen, is literally, I mean, John Watts's first movie, he took, you know, hand-drawn storyboards and made a full animatic of the movie, read the script over it for each character, and knew exactly, okay, this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece. I mean, that is the same concept applied to a smaller scale. But you know, the preparation remains the same. It's just sort of knowing what's going to be there and knowing how each shot is going to be achieved.
I want to take a moment and talk about Shutterstock.com. Now, you're probably thinking that I'm only going to talk about their footage library, their image library, their music. No, not this time. Yes, of course, you should go there and check it out because it's amazing stuff. But no, I'm talking about their blog. And why am I talking about their blog? It's because in the past couple of weeks, I've been paying more attention to it. And there's some really inspiring stuff on there. There really is. I find that the Shutterstock blog is really dedicated to giving us creatives the tools to be better at our craft, which is really great. So I go over there all the time and check it out, especially in the past couple of weeks. I've been focusing heavily on it. And my attention's been toward the business section because I like to learn different things. You know, I'm building my production company and little business tips here and there are always valuable. One that I really enjoyed just recently was called Increase Creative Output by Navigating the Creative Partner Economy. And that was a really great post. Of course, they have stuff on editing and design and video production. I happen to like the business one right now, but it doesn't matter because it's a place to go to find inspiration, learn, become better at your craft, be inspired, build your personal businesses. Like, this is a blog for you. So head over to Shutterstock.com, click on blog, and just look around for a while. Get inspired. There's really excellent stuff out there, and I know you guys are going to love it, especially if you're listening to this show. That is the content for you. And lastly, I want to talk about Hedge. Hedge.video. Well, Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast. It's a lot better than dragging files all around your Finder. That's not the professional way to do it. It's just not. You know, you're a professional. You get paid for your work, right? You take your work serious. You want to have professional tools. And Hedge.video is a professional tool for backing up your media. Okay, so this is how I use it. I get my media cards from my camera operators, audio people, all of it, behind the scenes photographers, all of it. I bring it into Hedge. So you can import with Hedge multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations. So I import all of my sources, all the media cards, they're all there. And I always set two destinations because I like to have two copies of everything before we end our shoots. So I have my sources, I have my destinations. I click transfer and I just let it go. Let it go. It's seamless. And I have the Hedge Connect app on my phone. So when the transfer is done, I get notified. It's as simple as that. So it's professional. It's a professional software. It's reliable. You get notified when it's done. You know it's being done correctly. And it just gives you the peace of mind because your media is everything in this business. So you just want to use professional tools. And Hedge is that. Now, if you go to hedge.video/go-creative-show, you're going to get 20% off the full license. But there are multiple other licenses that you can try as well. So it's all there at hedge.video, hedge.video/go-creative-show. All right, let's get back to our interview with Matthew Loy talking all things Spider-Man and so much more. Is there ever any room for just random inspiration that comes on the shoot day? Like, do you get to just come up with things on site, or is that basically just can't happen because of time and money and you need to have the exact shots you need?
I think that the what's great about Marvel movies is that they have so much spectacle, but there's also these wonderful, just simple, amazingly done dialogue scenes,
yeah,
you know, that people forget, like that's just two actors, you know, using their craft to hone characters and create like just dynamic on-screen storytelling, you know what I mean? In the simplest way. And so when you get, you know, Sam Jackson, Jake Gyllenhaal, Tom Holland, or, you know, anywhere, I mean, Thor Ragnarok is a great example of that, where you just have these wonderfully hilarious scenes between these actors and they're not, you know, it's not big action. It's not complicated. And in those situations, there's tremendous improvisation, new lines, new different blocking, different, you know, once they're in character and they feel empowered to work within a scene, you can have tremendous improvisation that goes on. The bigger set piece action things are, it's harder to improvise, obviously, because a lot of things have been, prepared in a certain way, and they may not, you know, you may have said, okay, well, we're going to come up and over the bridge, so we're only going to build this one facade because that's the shot. We're not going to invest in whatever it is, $100,000 or $200,000 to turn around and do the other side because we've kind of agreed this is that shot. So you may not have the same room for improvisation. That said, once it's in post-production, tremendous repurposing is going on, and things that were once going to be used for this are now being used for that. And, you know, and the VFX gods can work tremendous magic with utilizing different assets to create different scenarios. An actor you thought was going to be in this scene is now in this scene, and the backgrounds have changed, and suddenly there they are. You know, it's really impressive what can be done. So, you know, I mean, obviously some of it is locked in, but you try to remain fluid because, again, the name of the game is the best movie possible. So, you know, you always want to be listening to movie gods and knowing that, you know, if the idea seems correct, you probably want to go for it.
What I found really interesting is people were cheering and clapping throughout the whole movie. But what got the biggest clap was at the very end when Spider-Man and MJ hold hands. And I'm thinking to myself, we just watched millions upon millions of dollars and hours and manpower to make like one of these action scenes. And the applause went to the two hands coming together. And it was an interesting moment because I'm like, that is what film is. That's storytelling. No matter how much you throw at an audience, what they want is the story. You got to have the story. And it was kind of an interesting moment to witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that is not the first time that I've heard that observation. It definitely comes down to some really simple things, you know. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's really, you know, cave paintings and firelight at the end of the day, you know. that's what we've been doing for a long time.
I love that. I wanted to talk to you about the way that you created this holographic world, because later in the film, it's revealed that what people are seeing is really a hologram of something else. And in some of the action scenes, the environments are changing throughout the entire thing, especially near the very last big battle scene in London. I was watching that and I'm thinking, which one is the real set? Is there a real set? Is this live action at all? It was so fluid and so interesting to watch. I had no idea what was real, what wasn't. And I think that's exactly where you want the audience to be, because that's where the characters are. But now is the time to tell me the truth. what was actually real and what wasn't in those scenes? How were you achieving that holographic changeover in the locations?
Yeah, I mean, truthfully, I don't even know if I have the answer to this day. It was one of those things where it was just like forever ongoing with, hey, wait a minute. So if they're seeing that, then what is happening? You know, we're all just like many, 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 many years of professional movie making experience standing on the location being like, so he's got the, just trying to work out like what the logic of it, what, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly deep on some levels. What you're meant to be seeing. I mean, you know, our big thing was, you know, that when you're in the battle or what appears to be happening, that just needs to appear to be real to everyone that's seeing it. So, you know, the trickiest part actually about all of it was just the weather change and the look change and knowing that, you know, that part of the gag was going to be about, you know, that cloud, you know, there's sort of a cloud element and then, you know, and it's, I'm using sparse language here to avoid spoilers, et cetera,
No, don't worry about it, because by the time this thing is going to be coming out next week, and whoever really needs to see this film is going to see it. We spoil here. So what?
The weather patterns were the big thing of like, you know, you're going to have these light changes that happen as the illusions are revealing themselves and tracking those things. And then obviously the color correction became very tricky. There were sort of the same footage was going to be used in various situations within that experience. So, you know, Francesco and I, the wonderfully talented DIT, who I've known for many, many years, you know, we sort of had to go through and grade a few variations of the same footage so that you would have kind of an A side to it and a B side to it. And that would help the audience kind of understand, okay, the illusion's over. We're back to, you know, so that was the attempt there was to kind of try to keep that organized. You know, obviously in the heat of battle, it does escape you from time to time. So hopefully, I watched it all probably 3 weeks ago in IMAX at Disney when we were doing the final couple of reels, in the DI. And I did feel like it was all there in terms of the logic of what was happening and how the look was sort of changing to satisfy the logic of the scene.
I agree. I mean, yeah, there is an element of confusion and where am I, what's going on, but that's kind of the point. And mm-hmm. you're supposed to not trust anything. You mm-hmm. just don't, you don't know what's real and what's not, which is exactly where you want your audience to be. So I love that. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, good, good.
What did you shoot the film on?
We used, you know, sort of a funny story with the format, actually, because most of the Marvel stuff is being done in the Alexa 65 format, the large sensor.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of where we started, was going to be an Alexa 65 experience, which is fine. I mean, it's a very large machine, and it also, you know, can be tricky on the focus pullers because it is a very, very large sensor. But, you know, it's a great format for the correct job. Anyway, we were kind of going down that road. And then we got a call from post-production at Sony that said, well, we're not really seeing the advantage of the 65, you know, the large format sensor in our 2K releases. So can we entertain, you know, 2K capture, or not 2K capture, but, you know, a lower resolution format. Huh. For a 2K release. And so I said, yeah, you know, I mean, I've worked with the Super 35 size sensor in the Alexa for years and years and made tons of movies on it. And it's a great tool. It also simplifies some of the filmmaking a little bit. You know, the cameras are much, much smaller. They can be formatted in different configurations a lot easier than the Alexa 65, which really is quite a sizable instrument. So yeah, we ended up on Alexa minis actually, which was great because it was just one camera body could do anything we needed to do. We needed to go, you know, underwater, crane, cables. We had tons of them. They could go, you know, between second unit, main unit, you know, you just sort of had one instrument that was set up the same way. Accessories were all the same, everything, you know, it just sort of made life a little bit easier for the gang. Cause we sort of could do everything from plates to panos to live action to CG elements, whatever, could all be on the same machine. So, you know, and that makes lenses easier, makes mapping easier, makes, you know, a lot of the stuff we have to do, a lot of the legwork involved in sort of the sausage making of these things. You know, if you're mixing formats, mixing different lenses, mixing, you know, it can get very cumbersome. So it was very streamlined, actually. I was sort of pleased that we were able to do that in the end.
What was your lens package that you were using for the film?
I use, generally speaking, when doing spherical work, I've used the Zeiss Master Primes for a good number of years. I just find that they, from sort of a technical perspective, they are all basically the exact same size, basically the exact same diameter. They all open to the same stop. Their close focus is all very much the same. It provides a baseline sharpness, resolution, and open iris scenario that is exactly what you need when you're really doing a complicated job where you don't want a ton of variables. I sort of think in the world of these large CG movies, a lot of guys are, oh, well, I really want lens characteristics and I want all this, but it can really cause some headaches for our friends in VFX. And I try to...
Why is that?
Just because you don't have optics that are operating the same as anything else. So each, you know, when you start to get into a lot of the vintage stuff or a lot of the rehoused glass that has some wonderful quality to it, it's just not the appropriate venue for it, I found, because then you have this one 35 millimeter lens, for instance, that you love, but then second unit goes to shoot a plate or someone needs to go and shoot an element for a shot that's done on that lens. You have that lens, they can't, so then they're doing it on a different up. So it just doesn't really fit together in the same way. Whereas, like, I know if I order six, you know, 50 millimeter Zeiss Master Primes, you are almost 100% guaranteed that they're going to come up flat, that their focus characteristics are going to be the same, their flare characteristics are going to be the same. Like, it is the most sort of robust, solid optical system that I've come across, and all the way through the range from, you know, the 14, I think, is the widest, all the way to 135 or whatever it is now, 150 maybe. They're remarkably matched, and even set to set, where you're not, you know, you really almost don't even have to map every serial number because, you know, they are so solid and they travel. I mean, you know, it's like there's other great spherical lenses, but can they travel? Can you get them in a case and send them to another country? And, you know, because otherwise you're into renting new sets in every country, new serial numbers, new variables, things have to get reprepped. And so on a movie that was going to span this many places and have units all over the place and, you know, second unit staying behind Italy while we're shooting New York, and, you know, all these things, you just want to have a baseline, quality that is dependable. So that's why we went that route. And I've gone that way on a few kind of bigger VFX things where I just felt like it wasn't worth the complication of having any kind of one-off lens flavor, because it can bite you later.
Is the visual direction up to you and your director for the most part, or does Marvel kind of have a set of standards for their universe?
There are certainly technical standards that are you know, sort of vigilantly adhered to in terms of color pipeline, workflow, all those sorts of things. I mean, we did actually sort of adjust our color pipeline a bit on this one. Again, with my good friend Francesco, he sort of had an idea about a little bit of the dailies color that could be adjusted to streamline it a bit and make it a little bit simpler, potentially, especially given how many different countries and circumstances we were going to be in.
Yeah.
But no, typically, I mean, the technical thing is basically mandated. And then, you know, I mean, it's I sort of say, look, like this is a very... this is a beloved universe. And when you get people showing up saying, oh, I'm going to change, I'm going to make it different, I'm going to, you know, you have to acknowledge that you're operating inside of a very popular, very scrutinized universe. So to sort of show up and say, oh, well, I'm going to do it my way, I'm going to make it different, I'm going to have, you know, whatever it is, whatever thing you think you should be doing, you have to acknowledge that no, it has to fit. It has to be a part of the universe. It can't be this sort of one-off thing that looks totally different from all the other stuff. But that said, you know, they don't really, I mean, there's if they don't like something, you know about it, but typically it's up to you to kind of, as long as you're working with that in mind. You know, our big thing on this one was just what was going to be neat was each kind of destination getting its own flavor.
Yeah.
And I
thought you guys did a great job with that. Like each one felt unique to itself and also representative of itself. Like they all look the way that you expect them to, and they actually do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we really did spend a lot of time thinking about that and trying to find ways that we could, you know, in the work that was being done on stage in England, like how is that going to match Venice and what's the quality of the light and the color palette and all those sorts of things are, you know, trying to fold all of that in so each place gets its own feel. And so that was really the captivating part of the look of that movie, was going to the places, looking at it, seeing what you were going to change in the real place, then bringing parts of that back onto stage and in the rigging and, you know, having to tweak sets a little bit to serve the action so that you're not altering history in terms of what the location is, but you're making small tweaks that let things happen a little bit more organically in terms of how the staging would occur, et cetera. So, that was a really nice part of the process for sure.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called Bleeding Gums by Brightside Studio. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Get a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. $49! And it's not just the individual song. You get cutdowns, you get loop sets, you get stems, so you can customize your track to fit your project perfectly. And also, since we've been talking about blogs today, their blog called The Beat is amazing. It's an excellent resource for filmmakers, and you guys should be checking that one out too. So head over there, premiumbeat.com, listen to their music, get their sound effects, and check out their blog. And last but certainly not least, Rule Boston Camera. Now, Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent your production equipment. Why? Well, because they have a gigantic inventory. Rule is like the main source of rental gear for all the Hollywood films that come through Massachusetts and New England. So think about it. You're renting from the same place that the Hollywood films are renting from. So you know they gotta have a lot of stuff, right? They have tons of it. It's in really good quality. And the other thing, too, is that they understand their gear better than anybody else. If you're renting, it's because you probably don't own. And if you don't own, you may not know everything about that piece of gear. And where Rule really shines is their attentive service. They make sure that before you even leave with your gear, you understand what it is, how to use it. They give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out on your shoot, and they're committed to support you throughout your entire production. And that is no joke. So what does that all add up to? Peace of mind. Peace of mind, which is really what you need when you have a whole bunch of gear that costs a lot of money and every day, every hour, every minute is hundreds, thousands of dollars. So aside from the world-class inventory, you also get amazing support for your lighting, grip gear, communications, camera dynamics, cameras, lenses. They have everything that you're looking for and the support you need. So head over there at rule.com, RULE.com, and check it out. All right, we're coming down to the end here, but there's still so much more to learn from our guest, Matthew Lloyd. I just want to wrap up our Spider-Man discussion with an audience question. And then if you can stick around for like another 5 minutes, I wanted to talk to you about your commercial work and your fashion work. Audience question on Twitter from Jason F. He wants to know, let me see this here. He wants to know, when Spider-Man's swinging from the webs, is any of that practical, or is that all CG?
So John Watts and Yannick Sirs, who's his visual effects supervisor and a wonderfully talented man, have a theory that was adhered to for basically all of the movie, which is no matter what, something for every shot needs to be photographed, whether or not it's a plate, an element, a piece of mocap work and a volume later, whatever's happening on the screen, they want some real world reference of what it is. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't get wholly replaced in CG, but when the director's cut is happening, there is a piece of photography for basically every shot in the movie. That can be very difficult, obviously, but we do it, and we do adhere to that principle where we really try to, have some physical photographic element to at least inform, sort of call it invaluable reference, to at least inform what will later happen in CG or be wholly integrated into the shot in a real way. Tom Holland does a ton of all his mocap, because he has this sort of amazing physical capability to perform the Spider-Man character in the suit. So a lot of that stuff is Tom in mocap. A lot of that stuff is Tom in the suit on location. There's great shots of him. I mean, they did some huge swings on this thing. Where you sort of go, really, isn't that just going to be in CG? But no, it ends up, at the very least informing the CG, and if not, being integrated into it.
Wow.
And then Yannick and I spend a long time, just kind of going back and forth with how to light the CG and what the lighting scenario was on the location, and how should we adjust the lighting on the CG to integrate it. And, if there's a shot that we didn't do any photography for, he'll sort of say, well, okay, how would we have lit this? Where would the sources be? And he'll start kind of send me a few images to inform how the CG is lit, which is a super important part of the whole thing. I mean, people forget, like, each one of these shots has to get lit. I look at the trailer for Lion King and I just think, like, Caleb did such an amazing job, given that that's like holy CG lighting. There's nothing real world going on other than his taste and experience and knowledge informing how the CG characters are lit. And it just looks stunning,
In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about two things. You do some really beautiful commercial work and also some really gorgeous fashion work too. And I actually want to start with that, because I think a lot of people try to break into this fashion film world. And I'd love to know how you prepare for a fashion film and what the differences are between what you do for a narrative, commercial, and certainly your major films.
Well, the fashion stuff is interesting because it sort of became its own field in a way. There was this period, like maybe 10 years ago, where sort of high-end digital motion became possible again. And you had these scenarios where, there was a fashion shoot with a big fashion photographer and they would also want a motion component. And so it kind of created this fun, low-stress world where you could do some interesting things. A very dear friend of mine is a incredibly talented and celebrated fashion photographer named Todd Cole in Los Angeles, who had a great relationship with the Redarte girls, who, had made wonderful clothes and really had a strong visual sense and a strong brand sense. And they really kind of empowered him to make basically these little movies. I think we made two or three together in 2 or 3 years. And, those we really prepared like a movie. I mean, obviously there was a closed component. You wanted to be able to see certain things, but it was about, characters and space informing the product, which is the clothing. And that really became the design interface, was, how do these clothes function within the scene in a dynamic way? How are we showing them in a dynamic way? Because it's easy enough to just get a model and go to Death Valley and spin around them with a Steadicam and have blow some wind on them. I mean, that's not rocket science. But when you get to, I think the first one of those Redarte films was like they shot at SpaceX and they had all kinds of futuristic stuff going on, projections. And it was really, a dynamic way of showcasing these wonderful garments that the girls had made. I think they even subsequently went on to direct a movie too. It's like, it was really a special time where a lot of dynamic stuff was getting made. It kind of replaced the music video, strangely, for a while. And now people are kind of hip to it. So it's gone back to a more commercial situation where there's kind of a branded campaign that gets pitched and people will, you know, bid on it and the director will get awarded the job. And then it becomes, you know, a little bit more of just pretty people poolside with clothes on. But when it can be sort of a little bit edgier, I think it's a great format, you know, because you're not, it's not TV based. It's not fitting it into a particular time. It can be just a little bit bigger and more sprawling. So yeah, if you haven't seen those things, you should really watch Todd's Rodarte films. Are pretty special.
Yeah, I'm looking at them right now. I saw them previous. I'll put a link to them in the show notes. I mean, this is so much more than going to an American Eagle and seeing the video on the screen. This is like, and that stuff's beautiful too. I mean, great, whatever. But this is like storytelling. This is music video. And actually, it was interesting because the way that I kind of found it on your site, it popped up first. I didn't see the header, fashion. I just clicked on it. The audio wasn't on. And I was thinking, what video is this? because it really does look like a music video and it has storytelling and it's really beautifully shot. Now, for people that, I think this is an interesting industry for people to get into, cinematographers and directors. For people that want to get into this, what do you think are the most important elements of a fashion video that people should focus on? Should they try to pair up with a stylist, or is it better to pair up with a great gaffer or a locations person? What do you think is a good first step into leaping into this industry?
I can only sort of speak to what I saw Todd do really well as compared to some of the other things that I had done in that world, which were successful, but just sort of more your standard fare. You know, he always just kind of had an image, you know, for the Elle Fanning one with the star in the barn, there was a beautiful piece at the Tate Modern years ago that was a setting sun in the middle of their big hall that just sort of sat there and glowed and lit the whole space, and they shut the house lights off and it kind of had this. So he sort of pondered that image for a while, and really it just became, you know, it's all about the location. You know, where can we stage something? Or in the first Rodarte one, where it was the SpaceX, you know, sort of this futuristic sci-fi feel, you know, where can we sort of stage these scenes that have scale and are dynamic, and are, because that's the simplest way to it. I mean, typically the people in these things are going to look good and the clothes look good. And that, you know, that part will sort of, if you have the right brand, will sort of take care of itself, I think, to some degree. And rightfully so, you know, I mean, that's really their world and that should be, it's their showcase for that work. But I think as far as the sort of motion, the visual component of it, it's where can you stage this that's engaging, that has sort of built-in drama, built-in narrative, you know, that isn't just sort of a beachy kind of, you know, the obvious places that you can go with these sorts of things. So I think, honestly, if you can get, you know, a great location and shoot it at the right time of day, a lot of that work is done for you. And then obviously it just becomes about how do I make this interesting and not the obvious, you know, sort of turntable mannequin experience, which can be challenging because it's by default that's what it is, and there are people involved that obviously just want that. So if you're going to elevate it, it's about how to do it intelligently, still give people what they need. Obviously they need to show the product and they need to do it, you know, very similar to what happens in commercials. You know, you have to sort of adhere to certain necessary points that should be met. So when you're thinking about how to elevate it and how to make it something people are going to want to watch beyond just the basic, default audience for those things, you know, that stuff to keep in mind. I mean, I remember I did a bunch of stuff with Gia Coppola back in the day that had, you know, we went to London, we did, you know, like a bunch of days around London. Like it, you know, really had like a fun European flavor. It, you know, always felt like a little bit more than just, you know, the default.
I am a huge fan of your work. I love your commercial work, your fashion stuff we just talked about. I am always drawn to those things because that's my company here in Boston is commercial and branded content, that type of stuff.
Right.
So that's the stuff I really respond well to and are gravitated toward. And I love, oh man, the work that you do in the commercial is excellent. But we've run out of time, so we can't dive into that right now. But it's okay.
Don't worry about it.
We'll definitely have you back for your next big film. And guys, please, Spider-Man Far From Home, you've got to see it. It's fantastic. I am not a huge comic book movie fan, and I enjoyed this from start to finish. So it looks amazing. The story's there. Visual effects are there. Cinematography certainly there. And we thank you so much for coming on the show to talk to us all about it.
All right. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Where can people go online to find you?
I think you can just type me into Google at this point. You'll find something.
Do you have an Instagram?
I do. @ Larry Chips.
What is that?
@ Larry Chips. It's a long story, but
Larry Chips?
That's it.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, and I will follow you as well. Mr. All right. Larry Chips, thanks so much for being on the Go Creative Show. Thanks a lot, Matt Lloyd. We really appreciate it, and we'll have to have you back.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
I want to thank Matthew Lloyd for coming on the show and sharing his experiences. That is what this show is all about. Sharing experiences, learning from one another. We are in this together, people. That's what Go Creative Show is all about. I also want to thank two people behind the scenes that are making this show possible. Connor Crosby, he is our producer and doing a fantastic job, and you can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And Matt Russell. Matt mixes and masters and makes this show sound so delicious. You can find him at gainstructure.com, gainstructure.com, and on Twitter at gainstructure. And remember, find us on social media because we are always posting when we have guests coming on and you have an opportunity to ask them your questions. Your voice can be heard. So follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And our sponsors, Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and PremiumBeat.com. Support those that support us. We'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.